Hello, I'm Anna Dixon.
And I'm Andrea DeCowie.
And on behalf of Apollo Bay WordFest, we'd like to welcome you to Warm Winter Words 2020. In Apollo Bay, we've been gathering as a town under one roof in winter on a Sunday afternoon to listen to Australian writers speak about their craft for 27 years. This event is known as Warm Winter Words, but the land on which we gather, read, write, converse, and learn has a much longer history of sharing stories. We're on Gadabunud country, and these traditional owners are the original storytellers. We pay our respects to elders, past, present, and emerging. There is so much we can learn from story and listening, and WordFest looks forward to the day when Indigenous words are woven into the Australian lexicon, celebrating the culturally rich, unique, and continuous voice that the First Nations people contribute to our national story.
We've got some fantastic Australian writers lined up for you today. Tony Birch, Lucy Treloar, and Michael Veitch, who are all in conversation with the wonderful Kate Mildenhall. All our authors have looked back into Australia's past to bring about some understanding for us today, whether it is exploring the relations and interactions between black and white Australia, early European settlers making their way in remote coastal communities like ours, or immigrants journeying here by boat in search of a better life. These tales, this past, gives us hindsight, the opportunity to reflect and decide to do things differently.
Lucy Treloar, with Wolf Island, also projects us forward in time, taking what we know today and imagining a future for us. It is bleak. Foresight? We hope not. And yet taking today's information on climate change and extrapolating forward is what we should all be doing, so that we firmly understand the decisions that we're making today.
Perhaps it takes people with imagination to do this for us, which is why, at this time in history, perhaps more than any other, we really need the arts, and particularly writing and words that impact, speak truth, bring solidarity, and offer us insight.
Kate will introduce you to our other marvellous guests, but I'd like to introduce you to Kate. Not only is she co-host of the First Time podcast, she's also author of Skylarking, which is longlisted for the 2017 FOSS Literary Awards and the Indie Book Awards. The novel centres around two friends who are growing up together on an isolated Australian cape in the 1880s, and it's been described as historical fiction at its evocative best. Walking around the Cape Otway and the lighthouse on that isolated cape in the middle of winter is sure to evoke Kate's characters of Kate and Harriet. Her much-anticipated second novel, The Mother Fault, is due out in September.
We are thrilled to have Kate bring this Warm Winter Words conversation to you today. A big thank you to Writers Victoria and the Grace Marion Wilson Trust for making this event possible. Thank you also to our authors. We're hoping at WordFest that we can actually host you in Apollo Bay at some time in the near future. Now, settle back with your cuppa in front of the fire and let these words warm you.
Tony Birch is a novelist, short story writer, poet and academic. He is the author of three novels, Ghost River, which won the Victorian Premier's Literary Award for Indigenous Writing, Blood, which was shortlisted for the Miles Franklin Award, and his latest novel, The White Girl, winner of the 2020 New South Wales Premier's Prize for Indigenous Writing and also shortlisted for the 2020 Miles Franklin Award. He is also the author of Shadowboxing and three short story collections, Father's Day, The Promise and Common People. In 2017, he was awarded the Patrick White Literary Award. Tony is a creative writing teacher, a frequent contributor to ABC local and national radio, a regular guest at writers' festivals, and a climate justice campaigner. He lives in Melbourne. Tony Birch, welcome to Warm Winter Words for Apollo Bay Festival.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, I do wish we were warm and cosy sitting down at Apollo Bay as we had planned to do. I'm still very glad we have this opportunity to speak. Had we been down there, we would have been speaking and telling stories on the traditional lands of the Gadabunud people. And I want to pay my respects to elders past, present and future. And also, as we're doing this via podcast, to the traditional owners of the unceded lands that I'm speaking from, the Wurundjeri.
Thank you very much.
Tony, I want to begin with water. If I can, yeah. In your novel, Ghost River, Wren's thoughts of the river were so constant he sometimes woke in the night. I want to ask, especially at a time like this when we're back in lockdown, are there watery places, either river or ocean, that constantly return to you?
Well, it's an interesting question to ask because I've actually just finished a poetry collection which is coming out next July, and one of the sections is called Water. And those poems are divided between, I suppose, the discussions of fresh water. So obviously, as with Ghost River, I've written several poems that are concerned with the Birrarung, the Yarra River, and certainly written some what I would call ocean poems. So I also have a fascination with seawater, which started when I was a teenager of about 13 years of age. And it sounds very odd, but I didn't see the ocean until I was 13. And I still remember the day that I was introduced to the ocean at Gunnamatta. And I think it was such a formative experience. I couldn't believe the level of energy of the water. And I've had a fascination with ocean swimming and rock pools, particularly along the Cape Schanck National Park, which is on Bunurong country, ever since. So, yeah, I've been writing a lot of poems to deal with water. I'm obviously concerned with water. I have been in my day job. So I've just retired or finished a five-year research fellowship looking at climate justice. And a lot of that work is concerned with, you know, the rising sea waters, but also the lack of fresh water for a lot of communities globally. And even though we're in lockdown, we are allowed to exercise. And a lot of my exercise is taken by the river, so that I've been writing a series of non-fiction essays recently that have been published, which are essays that deal with the relationship between personal grief and walking and place. So my younger brother died very suddenly 18 months ago now, or getting close to. And in the months after he died, I spent a lot of time down at the river, particularly along the Yarra Bend National Park. And it is a very special place for me. So, yeah, all of those issues that concern my writing and my sort of emotional self have been to the fore in probably all the writing that I've done since I published The White Girl.
I'm so looking forward to reading those poems. That's wonderful news. Tony, if we go back, when did you first recognise yourself as a storyteller?
Oh, probably when I first tried to get out of trouble at home as a kid. I mean, it's quite interesting that, you know, I've got five children and we bring our children up to tell the truth. And I think that, you know, that's a good ethical way to raise children. But it seems odd to say, but when I was a child, to tell the truth could be very dangerous, whether it be talking to police or my father, who was a particularly violent man. So that I must say that I learned to tell stories as a kid to get myself out of trouble, and they work very effectively. So I think I knew that from a very young age. I think the relationship though between storytelling and writing was known to me very early, so that although I did some things at school very badly, I was very good at writing, and what we called at Christian Brothers School was called composition. So basically writing stories. And I was very good at it. And I think that I had a natural inclination towards storytelling. But then as I got older, I actually, and people often don't realise this, I think I published about 50 individual poems before I ever published a story. So I was writing poetry up until maybe the early 2000s, reading a lot of poetry. So I think I improved and became a better writer of fiction with the combination of a knowledge and experience of storytelling, but also an understanding of language, so that my philosophy as a reader and a writer I actually do believe in quite direct and simple prose. And I think that if prose is written well, it doesn't have to be convoluted, and it can carry a lot of weight, a lot of meaning. So those two assets in combination, I suppose, have really impacted on I suppose what you might call my signature, or the stylistic approach I take to writing fiction.
When you were writing that poetry, Tony, who were you reading? Who was influencing you?
A lot of people. So that people may not know that Raymond Carver, who's sort of renowned as a sort of, you know, a fiction writer, actually he wrote a lot of poetry, but he has a wonderful collection called All of Us, which is probably a major influence on me in poetry. Alice Walker's poetry I actually really enjoyed. Alice Walker has a poem called Women, which is one of my favorite poems, where there's a line saying, "These women had fists as well as hands." And I love the way the poem talks about women as being incredibly strong, assertive, but also loving. Anne Sexton, I read a lot of poetry by Anne Sexton. And in Australia, I would have read Pio. People might know Pio's book, 24 Hours. I actually think Pio's book, that book, is the most important book of poetry ever written in Australia. I think the way that he captures the language of the street and the shop front is very, very unique. And Pio actually introduced me to a, I suppose he would be called a Russian-American Jewish poet called Charles Reznikov, who produced a two-volume edition of poetry called Testimony, but it was actually based on court transcripts from courts in America. And work that I've done since, I have a series of poems called Archive Box, which came out over a number of years. And in this new book of poems, I have whole sections using archival material. Reznikov would be a really strong influence there. And also, I think that increasingly a whole number of younger Aboriginal poets, Sam Wagan Watson's book, which is quite old now, he brought out a poetry collection called Smoke Encrypted Whispers, which I think is remarkable. Alan Van Nerven, who writes poetry as well as fiction. Ali Kobi Ekerman is a wonderful poet, and probably the poet of greatest influence now is an Aboriginal poet from South Australia, Natalie Harkin, who's also done a whole series of archival poems, which I think are vitally important. So I still read a lot of poetry, but if anyone knows any of those poets, they're not mysterious. I like the idea of a poem that can be enjoyed on first reading, and then when you go back to it, the reading has more depth. So in other words, there's more and more meaning. So I'm not a reader who wants to look at a poem and need a week to understand what's going on. I just don't have that much time in my day.
I feel like you've just given us a kind of a reading list for a masterclass there. It's marvellous. Mm. Tony, I've been reading back over your work and I couldn't help but notice the recurrence of wonderful childhood bikes. Henry Lamb builds one for Sissy in The White Girl, and there's a treasured bike in the story Harmless in your collection Common People. Yeah. Can you tell us about your first bike and what adventures you had on it?
Well, this is going to surprise people. I mean, in my first book, Shadowboxing, I mentioned a bike. And there was a guy in Richmond who, he's not the model for Henry Lamb, but in the way that Henry Lamb builds a bike out of bits and pieces, there was a guy in Richmond when I was a kid in the late 60s and early 70s called Soft John. And Soft John used to build bikes out of, you know, bits and pieces of bikes that he would find around the traps. And Soft John would sell the bikes for about $2. And they would last about a week, and you know, a kid would be riding their bike down the hill from St. Ignatius in Church Street, and the handlebars would come off or something. But it's interesting. I sort of found bikes. So people used to just leave bikes, and around the river you'd just find rusty bikes, and you'd oil them and ride them around. But I never actually bought a bike until I was in my 20s. I bought my own first bike, and I've had bikes ever since. And in fact, one of the self-indulgent luxuries I gave myself is that when I was leaving my job, I've recently had a beautiful vintage bike made out of all 1970s material.
Oh, wow.
And also that I wrote a piece for The Age last Christmas. My younger brother, when he died, he was... there's a beautiful photograph of my brother Wayne at his funeral when he's sitting on the astride his dragster bike in about 1972, a beautiful red dragster. And the bike was stolen from our front veranda about 2 years later in Collingwood. And last year after he died, I went to the same bike maker who made my bike and showed him the photograph. We found an original dragster frame and we rebuilt my brother's bike from scratch, exactly the same or almost the same. And it was finished last year just before Christmas. So on Christmas Day, I rode the bike from my house to my mum's house and I looked a bit silly on a dragster. And we got everyone to ride it up and down the street, took photographs, everyone sitting on the bike. And then I rode the bike back home. My daughter came for Christmas from England, one of my daughters. I got four daughters and a son. She rode the bike, and now it's sort of in storage in the garage. So, yeah, the bikes have always been important to me. And in my new story collection, which also comes out next year in August, I have a story called Bicycle Thieves, which is a direct homage to the great Italian neorealist film called Bicycle Thieves. But it's about two brothers who had their bike stolen, and it's regarded as the greatest sin that you could commit in their neighborhood is to steal a bike. So it's about bikes being incredibly valued and almost sacred. And we've got to remember, a lot of people do ride bikes now, which I think is great. When I was a kid, people rode bikes out of sheer necessity. And if you stole someone's bike, literally it might be the difference between a person being able to get to work or not.
Mm. Wonderful stories. Thank you, Tony. You've talked before on the Garrett podcast about the importance of being in a place and open to the possibilities of what it offers when you're writing about it. The town of Dean in The White Girl is a fictional place, and you've described wanting to write the landscape of the past. How did you incorporate your knowledge of real places when you were writing The White Girl?
Oh, that was quite interesting. There's a wonderful American poet who's since passed for many years, Richard Hugo, who wrote a remarkable essay called Triggering Town. And Richard Hugo wrote that if you want to write about the town you're in, you go to another town.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, to carry the stories of the town you're in but not be bound by them. I think it's a really great trick, a gift for a writer. So what I did, although it's a fictional town more for a sort of cultural and political reason, in that I wanted the town to be a town that any Aboriginal person who grew up in southeastern Australia, literally, that western band through Victoria, western New South Wales into southwest Queensland, would be familiar with. So I didn't want it to be necessarily a Victorian, New South Wales or Queensland story, but a story that could be in any of those places. But I did go to a real town, and I was really interested in the way that the town was divided by a levee that had been built in the 1920s to protect the upper end of the town, the dignified and rich end of the town, from the poorer flat lands of the town where Aboriginal people and very poor white people had lived. So that actual town gave me the idea to think about creating that divide. And then what I did was that I came home and I actually created a really elaborate map of this fictional town of Dean, so that while it existed fictionally in my head, once I produced the map and I had different locations and thinking of the way that where people would have moved, it actually, I didn't think it as fictional any longer. It was the town I was working with. I could visualise it. I could see it. I could see the police station, the picture theatre, etc. So it wasn't hard to, and I took a lot of photographs of the actual town that I visited, and I did incorporate some aspects of the landscape of that town into the town that I created. And people ask me, what is that real town? But I've never told anyone, and you'll have to tickle me to find out.
At the heart of The White Girl is this incredible matriarch, Odette Brown. Can you tell us about her and what she represents?
Yeah, so obviously she doesn't represent, in this case, any individual Aboriginal woman, but certainly carries the strength and vitality of so many Aboriginal women I've known. Also that, I taught history at Melbourne University for many years, and I did a lot of research on Aboriginal women's grassroots political activism, mainly looking at Aboriginal women's letters. So women who'd lived on reserves and missions and for many decades had written really powerful letters, looking at anything from having their children returned to them to seeking a better roof over their head, improvement of rations, warmer blankets, everything. So these are the women that are the backbone of, I think, of Aboriginal communities across Australia. So in that way, I had many women who would become models. But she, Odette, had to be, in a fictional sense, a real person, an individual person. So they wanted to write a character who did have enormous strength and great love for her granddaughter, Sissy. And in some ways, her protection of Sissy makes Sissy, in some ways, herself a little naive, and possibly because of that she puts herself in occasional danger. But also that Odette, she doesn't have any of the sort of overt sassiness in front of someone like Millie Kahn in the novel. What Odette knows is what you might call sort of diplomacy. So unfortunately, she there are times when she has to keep her mouth shut and there's time when she knows she can open it, so that she has to negotiate her life in the town of Dean for the protection of herself and her granddaughter. And in that sense, I wanted to introduce a character who would people would understand as a woman who is continually, in a way, compromised. Her life is compromised in order to protect Sissy, but she fully understands that. So there's moments of, say, deference to the white woman she's making cards for. The woman she meets on the train, the sort of old, you know, agricultural sort of aristocracy is represented through that older white woman on the train. And while, you know, Odette would like to, you know, tell the woman to sort of button it, she knows she can't because that could be dangerous for her. And then, of course, her relationship with Sergeant Lowe, the policeman. So, yeah, that's reflected in, yeah, other characters. Jack Haynes, the Aboriginal man she meets at the railway station. Aboriginal people who have to continually check themselves, check themselves, check their behaviour in order to remain or experience some sense of relative freedom.
The novel explores, you know, the impact of these kind of horrendous policies and legislation which the state used to try and control and govern Aboriginal people. And in different ways you show characters like Sergeant Lowe who kind of follow the law to the letter in a way that borders on kind of psychopathic at times, and then those like Bill O'Shea who can turn a blind eye for both good and bad, and then those who kind of cleverly, I suppose, work within the system, like Dr. Singer and the clerk at the Aboriginal Welfare Board to do good within the system. Why was it important to you to show this kind of range of responses and behaviours, Tony?
Oh, well, I mean, it's obvious, and not to use a pun, but yeah, this is not a black and white situation. It's a very complex situation. So that several things. Firstly, that the legislation is contradictory, it's hypocritical, it's unpredictable, it's summary. So that what we know about Aboriginal people subject to different Aborigines Acts is that, one, they could be applied with, you know, incredible bureaucratic diligence, quite cruelly, but sort of in a way almost sort of without emotion. They could be negotiated with different policemen and welfare board officials, depending on those individual relationships. So, for instance, we know that in some towns in Australia, if the relationship between a local policeman and Aboriginal people was relatively sound, that people actually did go about their lives with some sense of relative freedom. So, people sometimes knew the local policeman through the football club or whatever. And, those sort of social interactions sometimes were valuable for Aboriginal people being able to live with some autonomy. But of course, the other issue is that, when you, thinking about people having to behave outwardly in a particular way, the real complexity and the real tension is that once Aboriginal people step out of line, the law could be applied in a very rigorous way. So a local guardian which is an official title, a local guardian was most likely to be the local policeman, possibly a religious minister, or possibly a justice of the peace. The point is that that person has a lot of authority because they report to different welfare or protected boards, and therefore an Aboriginal person must behave with due diligence, and if they don't, they're in trouble. And what I found in doing the research around Aboriginal women's writing, it became clear that when Aboriginal women became simply too vocal and when they persisted with that demand for human rights and social justice, the law sometimes came down on them in very severe ways. But I don't think it's hard for anyone to imagine if you have a child or grandchild in your care, and a person who has authority over your life basically says, well, if you don't stop agitating, if you keep demanding of us certain things that we're not going to give to you, your child will be taken away. So it is a really strong controlling mechanism, and Odette has to negotiate this every day. And by the time we get to 1960 or the early 60s, this doesn't have to be stated. It's just known. So Odette knows how to behave. Jack Haynes knows how to behave. And this is the way that the lives of Aboriginal people were governed, and in some parts of Australia would still be governed.
I wanted to touch on that, Tony, because as you're speaking, all these the comments that you're making about, particularly about Aboriginal women and the ways in which they understood how to behave and not to step out of line, just are lines from this discourse that we're hearing at the moment in terms of the Black Lives Matter movement, and particularly from from women and Aboriginal women who I follow on social media at the moment saying, you know, we are constantly checked. They are constantly checked in the way that they have to behave and speak. So how much has changed in this area? Like, how bloody far do we have to go?
Well, I think there's a long way to go. I mean, it's that, you know, you can point to remarkable change and you can also see a complete lack of change. I think the issue, there are several issues. The one regarding Black Lives Matter, it is vital to understand, of course, that there has been a great sort of sense of global solidarity around this issue. And people know that there have been recent acts in Australia around Black Lives Matter. It is important to know that the issue for Indigenous people globally and in Australia is quite particular. Certainly it's an issue of colour, of skin colour, but it's also an issue of country, so that violence against Aboriginal people in Australia, particularly the ongoing violence against Aboriginal women, is related to the violence against country. That is clear. Historically, that's been clear. An Indigenous scholar from Turtle Island, what people may know as Canada, Leanne Simpson, in one of her essays, and I follow her work a lot, she says, you know, to get to the land, they had to take the women and children. And I think that simple but clear statement is one that's reflected in what happened in Australia. The other issue here is, of course, that I think Aboriginal women, it's a double bind. They do have to check themselves regularly in white society, in colonial society. And, you know, for many Aboriginal women, they've still got a battle to have their voice given authority within Aboriginal communities. Mm-hmm. Now, what's happened historically is that since colonial invasion, that, yeah, you're talking about a white patriarchal society, a very violent society, and when so-called negotiations and discussions have been held with Aboriginal people, it's often been white men talking to Aboriginal men and giving Aboriginal men some limited sense of autonomy and power. And I think historically and in a contemporary sense, Aboriginal women have been locked out of those discussions. Now, whether that be Aboriginal women's knowledge, vital knowledge of country and protection of country, or their role within communities, there's a real absence of their authority. And we all know that, you know, Aboriginal women often hold communities together. And I'm not trying to say just in a domestic or maternal sense. I'm talking about as real cultural leaders. And personally, I've been so fortunate. So I said earlier, I've just finished a five-year position at Victoria University. And I worked in the Mundani Baluk Aboriginal Centre, and it's dominated by really strong Aboriginal women. I mean, the two old fellas, me and Gary Foley, we get bossed continually, and we get bossed for good reason to say we love you, but, you know, you're not running the show here. Yeah. And you can actually see it in a tangible sense. So I would like to say to people, because this book is, you know, we don't have violence on the page. It's a very tender book, but the threat against violence against Aboriginal women and their bodies is ever present, is that I was at Melbourne University for 20 years as both a student and staff member. I don't ever remember having a discussion, say, about domestic violence. I'm talking about a social, personal discussion. Now, some of that would be because people are embarrassed and wouldn't want to talk about it. Some, it's a secret issue amongst the middle class, and some isn't. I understand this. Feminists having that discussion didn't want to have a discussion with men. That's fine. I understand all that. But being at Mundani, we've discussed issues of domestic violence often and in very informative, very enriching ways as Aboriginal people. And that's because the women involved in those discussions are leading the discussions, and they see, well, my input, the input of other men there, as invaluable. But it's a very particular, you know, yarning circle of Aboriginal people. So when you ensure that women are at the centre of those discussions, they really enrich your community. It's why I'm not a great proponent of men's groups. I'm a proponent of community groups that are led by women in this area. And I think it's been a wonderful, it's been incredibly enriching experience for me. And this is directly relative to The White Girl, because when I wrote The White Girl, the three women I thank in there, Kim Kruger, Paola Bala and Karen Jackson, are all colleagues of mine at Mundani. And they read the first several chapters of the book, not a sort of cultural detectives or giving it their stamp. I wanted them to know this woman, and the talks we had around our debt were really invaluable for how I went on with the novel after that.
Tony, you mentioned domestic violence there, and I want to jump to a question that someone from Apollo Bay has actually put forward to ask you. Jane Buckingham asks, many of your books depict vulnerable women and children who have an abusive adult in their life, and we know domestic violence is rife in every community. Jane asks, was it your main intention to highlight abuse in its different forms or to provide a message of hope in the strength these individuals find? I wonder if you can talk to that.
Yeah, well, I suppose that it's not an issues approach, so that I think the first time I wrote about domestic violence was in my first book, Shadowboxing, and it's a very strong theme in the book, stronger in Shadowboxing than anything I've done since. That was simply because it's a very autobiographical book, so I grew up in a house where, in a very violent house, so that violence was sort of, it came with breakfast. And writing about domestic violence in my family life was because that's just, you couldn't shy away from it because it formed everything about our lives. I'm very fortunate that my mom and my grandmother, I mean, the issue of domestic violence has never been a secret in our family and never been an issue that wasn't for discussion. And I'm very lucky for that, so that we never hid the fact that the stories of violence about my father. And in fact, you know, as so often is the case, we have some very funny stories of the blackest humor around domestic violence. And that seems odd to outsiders, but yeah, once my, and this is in the book Shadowboxing, my mother, my dad was drunk and coming home and in a very violent mood. My mother was about 8 months pregnant with my, with my younger sister, Tracy. And we tried to hide her in the wardrobe because she was so pregnant. Her bum was really big at the time. She wouldn't worry about me saying this. And we were trying to push her into the wardrobe and we couldn't fit. My dad is chopping the front door down with an axe, like with an axe, like, you know, The Shining. And we're just piercing ourselves laughing because we can't get her in the wardrobe. So when we tell that story to each other, we laugh. And if someone was watching it, they go, what? Yeah, they can't get it. So so the first point is to say it's an ever-present issue in my life. Second would be to say I write about it, I hope, with all the responsibility it requires, so that I'm a sort of writer who believes in responsibility, so that I have occasionally been questioned, and I mean in invaluable ways, so that I remember a feminist scholar said to me, you know, do you think you are depicting women in a way that values them, or, you know, do you consider the issue of voyeurism and, you know, victimhood, et cetera? And she was right. Yes, I consider all those issues, and you have to take it very seriously. But ultimately, I suppose my view is that because domestic violence is so endemic in Australian society, we'll get nowhere by not talking about it, not being part of our art. And I think there is a cultural and class distinction of how it's read. So while people might make a criticism of representations of women in my work, they could, those criticisms often come from people outside both my class and culture. So within my class and culture, people understand. So my mum, for instance, who has read all my books, she feels that my representation of domestic violence in Shadowboxing not only was true to our family experience, but true to the way that I portray my father in that, or the character who represents my father. So I think that when you write about violence, you have to take enormous responsibility for it. And the last aspect of that question about hope, well, I think I'm not overtly saying I want to show hope, but what I would suggest is that in my work, I hope that people recognise that the characters involved, particularly the women, are very strong, and that if there is hope, it's to give value to those women and their lives. Men don't often come out too well in my fiction. I've tried to improve their lot, but sometimes I just can't do it. I've got a bit softer with the men.
Yeah, I feel like that. I feel like one of the characters I wanted to ask you about, you know, Jack Haynes. I really wasn't familiar with the exemption policy, which mm-hmm. Jack kind of, you know, brings forth in the book. when he first talks about it, it's really clear to Odette how much shame is involved in the decision he's made. And I want to ask how you feel shame has been weaponized and used in a systemic way against Aboriginal people in this country.
Well, I think in regard to the exemption acts, which were not, by the way, a Victorian policy, but very common in New South Wales and Queensland, I think they were deliberately created to shame Aboriginal people. So basically what they allowed you to do was to be exempted from the Aborigines Act. So it's not that you'd become a non-Aboriginal person. You may in a sort of some senses bureaucratically, but simply to exempt yourself from the Aborigines Act, which would give you some greater freedom potentially, would give you the right to have your own children in your care potentially. What I see the Exemption Act is a terrible device to control Aboriginal people's behaviour, so that we know Jack Haines, we know that in real life, people did, the numbers of people who actually chose to get an exemption are not that high. I think in Queensland, I may be wrong here, but I think it's a couple of thousand exemption certificates were granted. But people made those decisions for pragmatic, desperate human reasons, you know, to protect themselves and their family. But what happened once they gained exemption is that they weren't granted freedom. They were granted limited freedom with a sort of a level of control. So in the case of Jack Haines, we know that when he meets Odette at the railway station, he's almost boastful about the fact that he calls himself as good as a white man. And that's, by the way, a very common saying, yeah, you're a real white man, you're as good as a white man. That's a historical sort of saying in Australia. And that when then he's confronted with a question by a policeman a few minutes later, he's really humiliated by that policeman who puts him back in his place and treats him like a child. So it's a example of the way that identity legislation is used to control Aboriginal people. It's also relative, again, to the complexities around identity. The book is deliberately sort of, no, there is no certainty around identity in the book. And I would say that that mirrors the fact that there is no certainty around identity in the life of any Aboriginal person. In a legislative sense, the number of legislative acts and, you know, clauses and changes that have governed Aboriginal identity are literally in the hundreds in Australia. Mm-hmm. And so that an Aboriginal person could never have any legal certainty about who they are and were during the 20th century, and that people could find their status change quite dramatically with the stroke of a pen. So what it represents in the case of Jack is that he outwardly has a sort of sense of pride about being freed from the act, but in reality he doesn't have any more freedom than Odette.
You were quoted in The Guardian about the white girl, and it's a great quote. You said that I'm really proud of this book, but I'm not confident that any book or piece of art has the ability to fundamentally shift many people. You go on to say, you know, if people ask, do we write more climate change fiction? I say, no, we can get down on the picket line. Mm. Tony, I feel like there's a lot of picket lines right now to be on, both in terms of the rights and lives of Aboriginal people, for instance, and also in terms of the climate crisis. What actions do you reckon we can take as individuals to start shifting thinking and making change?
Yeah, look, firstly, I'll just go back to the quote, and I don't want to undermine the value of writing, because I write, but also I read like crazy. I've always, and reading has been, you know, other than running, reading has been my stability in my life. So I don't want to contradict myself, but yeah, reading has been absolutely vital to me. What I meant there and what I would still say is that I feel that the hope that we put in literature or in art is I think overinflated. So that I can give a really tangible example. I'm 63, and there wouldn't be a person, I don't think, between the ages and 50 and 60 and sometimes younger, who didn't go to school and read and were studied particular books by George Orwell, 1984 and Animal Farm, or Aldous Huxley's Brave New World. And these books are about the evils of totalitarianism. Mm-hmm. Simple as that. And so that so many kids in the Western world would have grown up on Orwell. And the lesson in Orwell's books is that, you know, totalitarianism is bad, you know. Mm. And yet we find ourselves in a global environment where we have some of the, you know, the worst political leaders of my life and many lives in democratic systems. So, you know, whether it be Donald Trump in the US or Boris Johnson stumbling along in the UK or in parts of the world where totalitarianism is still in place. While when I was growing up, there was a sort of Western democracies and then these two evils of the USSR and China, or supposed evils of USSR and China. Now we have this strange spread of totalitarian regimes, both in democratic and non-democratic societies, and they've overtaken liberal democracy. So these are very powerful forces. So I'm just wary of what we can do. Having said that, I wouldn't stop enjoying art, reading books, writing books that didn't try to have an impact. So as an individual, I don't think books have impacted on my ability to change the world. They have impacted on what I think about the world, which I think is different. In regard to climate change, I think it's we are seriously in a holding pattern because of the COVID crisis. What it has shown, of course, is that in a material sense that, you know, with the shutdown of some industries, we've seen a sudden improvement of natural environments. I think that when we come out of this disaster, this medical disaster, I actually think that people are going to make much more strategic and I think much more careful decisions about how money is spent. And I mean that as individuals. So I actually think, you know, I'm not one who says, yeah, we rely on the marketplace to solve the climate crisis. But I think that I've noticed in the last couple of months there's been a continual more disinvestment from fossil fuel and coal. So I think the market will play some role there. But you're asking, I actually think you're asking a metaphysical and psychological and spiritual question for people who are spiritual. And what I believed in doing the climate justice work is that it's not a matter of thinking about letting the market shift towards renewables. It's not about material policies. They're the outcome of, I think, we need a generational change of how we feel about living with each other, how we feel about the planet. And it's that odd thing of something has to be done now and something has to be done for the long term. So when I'm talking to my friends who live in the South Pacific, who are losing their land now, who are losing their homelands now, ancestral burial sites, et cetera, they can't wait for sort of generational change. They need action now. So we need that. And, you know, in some cases it'll be too late. But in the long term, we need a whole psychological shift about who we are. And one of the things that I think that the COVID crisis is highlighting is what sort of a community are we? And what happened, I think, is that we have seen some remarkable bonding of people. We've seen some remarkable grassroots, what I call low-level but important activism of people to work together. And we've seen incredible stupidity affecting our ability to stem the spread of the disease. And this offers up a lesson of which way we go. When you see the behavior of some large groups of people in particular societies, you know that it's the same way that people react to climate, and that is to do nothing about it, to ignore it. With the COVID issue, the outcome of doing nothing is felt very immediately and very acutely. And that's not going to stop. So in a society like the US in America, they're going to continue to lose many, many of their citizens until someone says stop. And I don't know if they're capable of doing it. I think in Australia, to a large extent, we have found ways to do that. And I think the test will come in the next 6 to 12 months about whether we can shift that, the quality thinking we've done and the quality actions we've done, to a different way of being. But one of the things that you learn by doing climate justice work is that you're only really are able to enact change for the long term if you actually think about yourself in relationship to country in a much more humble way. Yeah, you've got to have a much more humble attitude towards non-human species and country, that you've got to be beholden to country, not a person who thinks you can control the environment.
Thank you, Tony. It's so much to think about in there. I want to move briefly to your work as a teacher. You've been quoted as having a mantra, you'll be great, but only if you work your ass off. And I know that your students, I'm thinking of people like Alice Bishop and Michael Wheeler, you know, sing your praises. What is the most important writing lesson you teach your writing students?
Well, firstly, I don't teach anymore, although I do occasional so-called master classes.
Lucky people.
Well, yeah, what I would teach them, in fact, is that I start with something very simple, and that is that what I know about successful writers, so there's no sort of magic formula to write, no sort of 10-point plan, but one of the things that I've always done in my life is that I've followed writers' interviews very closely, and I don't mean sort of short interviews, very long interviews. The Paris Review since 1953 has been doing great interviews with writers. And writers are very, very idiosyncratic creatures, so that if someone says, oh, this is the way I wrote a novel and it worked for me, you can't think, oh, yeah, I'll do that. That'll work, because people have very individual habits and approaches. But one of the things that is common on any writer that's been successful is that they regard it as work. They do it as work, and they do it on a regular basis. They don't wait for inspiration. They have a method. So, you know, someone will say, well, I write 5 days a week. I only write in the morning between 9 and 12. Some people say, well, I like to sit on, you know, for 10 hours. And they're all different. But what they hold in common is a very clear idea in their head about what method brings about outcome. So you've got to learn, how do I get the best result from my writing? So, yeah, when students used to say to me, I sat in front of the computer all day in the blank screen waiting for something to happen and nothing happened, I say, well, don't sit in front of the computer. I used to say, get your notebook and a pencil, get your public transport, you know, your swipe card, get on the Frankston train or the Hurstbridge train, catch the train at Flinders Street, ride out to Hurstbridge and ride back into the city with your notebook with you. If you haven't got a story, by the time you get back, you're not going to be a writer. So it's about observation. So I think the other thing with writers is that most writers who succeed have, I think, really good observational skills and an almost insatiable sense of curiosity. So in other words, I'll see something and it just grabs my attention. It might be just a moment between a couple of people. It might be a physical appearance of someone, and I'm attracted to it, and then I want to engage more with it. So in a very old-fashioned way, I tell people to carry a journal around with them, or at least if they're using a phone now, something they can do notebook on or speak into, document the idea, because you tend to lose it, and have that regular work habit. The other thing, of course, is that a lot of people are very busy. So I would have taught, I used to do workshops at the writing centre and stuff. You're mostly teaching older women. And when I say older, yeah, women who have left school, you know, got businesses, got jobs, probably got kids. So women who are very busy. And what I say to those women, and, you know, the greater difficulty for those women is finding time. And I used to say, look, I understand that a little bit as a parent, but particularly as a woman, it's even a greater impact on you, sort of, you know, your working life, your domestic life. I say, look, one thing about a writer that you're entitled to some level of selfishness, but we know that's got to be negotiated around family and everything else and work. I say, look, if you could find 2 hours twice a week, but that was your 2 hours twice a week, and you stuck to that, you will, in that 4 hours a week, you will produce quality writing, rather than worry if you can't write every day. And I think the notion of writing full time is a luxury that very, very few people would even be able to consider. And I've never been able to do that. So, you know.
Tony, I mentioned to you that to replicate some of the experience that we would have had at Apollo Bay had we all been sitting together, I've asked your fellow panellists and some community members to put forward some questions. So this is a question from Lucy Trelaw. She says, I always wonder what characters mean to authors. I sometimes think of Jonathan Franzen saying that for him, characters exist to serve a purpose and he makes them work hard. She asks, do they feel real to you or like constructed beings that you move around? And in the aftermath of publication, do you carry them around with you in your thoughts and feelings, or do you draw a line between your novels and let them go?
Yeah, look, I'm not like Jonathan Franzen, and I wouldn't make them work hard. I want to have a better relationship with them. look, I do think of them as real people in the process of writing, and I do. I'm very big on voice, so once I get to understand how Odette speaks, I can hear and construct that voice. I'm not one who believes where they take on their own life, because I think, you know, if I don't like a character, I just kill them off. You know, it's not hard to get rid of them. But I, in the process of writing, yeah, I imagine them, I see them. And I think that I'm very intuitive around the emotion of a character, so that, in other words, in the, say, the relationship between Odette and Sissy, I would think, well, if Odette says this, would Sissy really react in that way? She's a shy, sometimes naive child. Would this response be something that would be out of character for her? So I consider that very deeply. But, yeah, I do. But, look, once the book is over, and this might surprise you, I've never read the book. I've never read any of my books once they're in print. I'll find a typo or something. But, yeah, when I get to talk to people like you about the work, I mean, my responses around people like Odette and Sissy are real. I don't see them as artificial constructs at all. So I think then I'm responding in a way like a reader. So when I read a book, and you wonder how people read. It sounds odd, but when I read, I can see the character, I can see the scene, so that the characters for me as a reader are entirely real, and probably as a reader more real. Lucy asked a question about after the event, I draw a line. I probably do draw a line under my own characters, because otherwise when you move on to a new book, you don't want them to inhabit the lives of your new characters. But as a reader, I think characters live on. The other thing relative to that, which my other panelists, it would show the distinction, is that when I write a character, I need to do certain things before I write a word, which other writers wouldn't do. So, for instance, I have to have their name, I have to have their age, I have to have a biographical sketch of the character before I write a word. So I can't write a character unless they're named. I wouldn't say, I'll call them so-and-so later. I'll just call them John until I think of the name. That would be like, my superstition says, if I call them John and not John, the character's not going to work. So they've got to be Odette, or they've got to be Sissy before the book starts.
Michael Veitch, who I know has interviewed you already, he asks, I sense that underlying what is at times a very grim story is a sense of optimism. Are you, Tony, an optimist, and how hopeful or not do you feel about relations between First Nations Australians and the rest of us going into the future?
Yeah, look, I don't describe myself as an optimist or a pessimist. I mean, I suppose I'm more of a pragmatist, that I just go with what's going. I think that the problem with race relations in Australia and anything around racism is that setbacks can be incredibly damaging and have a long effect. And I can describe this very quickly in an easy story. I was working with a lot of Aboriginal elders in a community hall in Laverton a few years ago, and we were working on them storytelling and them sharing their stories with other people at the Elderly Citizens Centre. It was going really well. I used to go in there on a Tuesday and we'd have food together, we'd have lunch. And I went on there one Tuesday and I've never seen this group of people more despondent, less interested in talking to non-Aboriginal people. And what had happened is the night before, the Four Corners program had exposed the torture of Indigenous youth in the Dundale Detention Centre. And that was such a setback emotionally for those people. It actually almost broke the project. So I think we need to consider this really closely, so that, you know, we build really strong relationships with each other, you know, between non-Aboriginal and Aboriginal people, and that can be really valuable and productive. And then something happens at a national level, which could be the racist comment of a politician, it could be the death of a person in custody, it could be something else, and it really guts people. And what that can do, it can have an impact on the trust between yourself and the person you know. And that's unfair, but that's the reality, because if you think of an Aboriginal person who have lost a loved one to violence, that person or that institution or that state mechanism is beyond reach. The person who's within your reach is maybe your neighbour. So that's possibly where the tension, you know, lands. And I think that's really unfortunate, but it's why we've got to consider what we do as a national community, not only a local community. Or at a local community, we have to find ways to build soft armour around ourselves that we can protect each other from those external forces. So what hopefully happens is that we learn to understand that the person next door or the person down the street is not the person responsible for this action, and we need to find ways to continue to grow together. So in that sense, you do see great, it's a bit like, it's not dissimilar from the climate work. You see remarkable successes at a local level, and then you see the stubbornness and recalcitrance at a national and regional level that stops us taking those projects further. So I think we're continually at the moment banging ourselves up against a brick wall of sort of, you know, government institutions or forces beyond our control, or forces much more powerful than us. And it inhibits, it's like, you know, the old notion of the glass ceiling. There are all these ceilings that are put in place to stop change being fundamental across society. And it's very frustrating.
a question from the Apollo Bay WordFest committee. They say, at WordFest, we're interested in words, the arrangement of words into works of beauty, argument and story. On RN's Weekend of Books, you spoke of the idea of stealing singular Indigenous words to name certain things and this being another theft from Indigenous Australians. So the Apollo Bay committee asks, how do we in Garubanu country connect with the language and story of that country, and what can restoring names, when can restoring names be a reconciling step?
Well, it's really interesting because one of the issues that is invaluable around the restoration of names is the relationship between Indigenous names and ecology. So that Bruce Pascoe's work since Dark Emu, he's talked about the value of words. So one of the things I would say to the people down there, which is, yeah, a beautiful country down there. It's such a pity we couldn't have done this on country. I demand to be invited back there in the future. is that I think restoration of language is vital to understanding the history of ecology and ecological knowledge, Indigenous ecological knowledge. So one, I would say that would be one great outcome. The way to do it, of course, is you've got to work with local community, local Aboriginal people, and sometimes those language restoration projects themselves are inhibited by a lack of funds, a lack of institutional support. So one way, and these are very practical issues, is that support for local Aboriginal language often requires support at a financial level to get people to, say, work on diaries, to work on early material. But I think there's a clear difference between the theft of language and the value of language. The theft of language is when it's done at a tokenistic level, at a level of sort of ornamentation. Like literally the name of a place can be like, you know, the old Aboriginal plaster stick figure in the garden. But I think that if we work on the restoration of language at a deep and full level, it's absolutely invaluable for both communities. And I have to say, just ending this, that I had the same experience or a similar experience when I was in Ireland and got to go to a Gaelic school. So I was teaching kids about climate justice in Ireland. And when you talk to fluent Gaelic speakers, and when those kids are learning their own Indigenous Gaelic language, it's not just about descriptive language. It is about how language is immersed in culture. And one of the beauties of Gaelic language is similar to Indigenous language is that a single word, having a single definition, is rarely the way that you think about language. Words tell whole stories on their own, so that I came away with a real respect of Gaelic. And I think that in a similar way that we could do, or we should be engaged in projects in Australia which restore language to restore cultural depth. So restoring a word simply to name a place doesn't do that. And even if you say, well, that word means so-and-so on its own, it's like sticking a word out on its own and leaving a paragraph behind. So there are really good ways to do it.
Tony, I can't let you go without asking for some reading recommendations, both for those of us who are still in lockdown and to help support our book industry in Australia. Can you tell us either what you've been reading or what you'd like us to be reading?
Yeah, look, in regard to Australian writing, clearly considering the issues that we've been looking at today, I love Tara June Winch's book, The Yield. By the time this goes to air, I think I will predict that she'll win the Miles Franklin Award for that. I think that's a remarkable book. I love a book by Alexis Wright called Tracker. I think that is a great book. I'm a sort of a reader who goes back, though, so that because I'm preparing to think about a new novel, I'm actually rereading a lot of novels by a Norwegian writer who I followed for many years called Per Petersen. I'm at the moment reading his novel In the Wake. His most well-known novel in English is called Out Stealing Horses, which has just been made into a movie. But also a book of his that I love is called I Refuse. I think it's his most recent novel in English. So if someone wanted to read a sort of a writer in translation, I'd suggest that you read Peterson. Other than that, I dip into my very wide range of short story collections and anthologies. So I tend to read a short story every day if I can. And if I were to recommend a short story writer internationally, the book is Ireland, the collected stories by Alistair MacLeod, which I really love.
Tony Birch, it has been an absolute pleasure speaking to you today. Thank you so much for sharing your stories and your wisdom with us and with Apollo Bay's Warm Winter Words.
Thank you very much for having me, and I hope to see you wonderful people in person in the future.
To find out more about Warm Winter Words, Apollo Bay WordFest, or any of our featured authors, you can go to apollobaywordfest.com. We are grateful for the support of Writers Victoria and the Grace Marion Wilson Trust and Colac Otway Shire. You can purchase books by all of our guests from readings. We look forward to gathering together in 2021 and welcoming you to Apollo Bay for WordFest.